Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I try not to do this too much, but I'm going to have to quote the Federal Reserve to you. Inflation has been high, Mr. Bernanke said today, and remains uncertain. So it's a good thing oil cranked lower again, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local service like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here. It is Tuesday, today the 5th of August. First things first as we get going. The Fed did nothing on interest rates. The short-term federal funds rate stays at 2%. Energy-based inflation is still a worry, though. Bernanke said he's going to keep an eye on it. If he was watching today, he saw oil close below $120 a barrel for the first time in a couple of months. Whether that'll last or not is why we've called Peter Butel. He runs the consulting firm Cameron Hanover. Peter, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So here we sit, down 20% in the price of a barrel of crude oil in about 3 weeks. What gives?
Well, it's been demand destruction. The curious thing here is that the consumer has had a lot more power than he or she were aware that they did have. Demand for gasoline, which is the main item that is produced by crude oil and the biggest item that we use here in the U.S., gasoline demand is down between 2.2 and 4.1%, depending upon which source or aggregate one uses. But that's been enough to pull gasoline prices down almost 75 cents a gallon.
What about things like speculation and the role of supply shortages? I mean, are you buying any of that?
Well, it wasn't traditional speculation by regular commodity speculators that pushed prices higher. It was really refugees from stocks and bonds that came into the market last August and September, when Ben Bernanke tipped his hand and let everybody know that he was going to cut interest rates. That, in turn, put pressure on the dollar, and we saw a huge amount of new buying come into the market in September last year that was from investment money. Some of those people may have been getting out recently, particularly since the dollar has been steadying recently.
Do you put much stock in the price of oil as an indicator of recession?
I actually do think that the oil market is a very good indicator of future economic activity, and I think that it is telling us right now that we're headed into recession.
So where do we go from here? Is this going to last, $118 a barrel?
Well, there are three major wild cards that could push prices right back up. If we were to have a hurricane like Rita or Katrina, if we were to see the Straits of Hormuz blocked because of various events going on with Iran and its nuclear program, the third thing is if Ben Bernanke starts talking about cutting interest rates, or if Jean-Claude Trichet, his counterpart at the European Central Bank, starts talking about raising rates in Europe, then we're going to see the dollar under pressure, and that could take away a lot of the inroads that we have made into prices. If we can make it through Columbus Day or so, without a problem at the Straits of Hormuz, without a hurricane like Rita or Katrina, then I think there's a very good chance we'll be looking at crude oil right around $100.
We're closer to 100 now than we are to 150. Is that your prognostication here?
Well, my feeling is here that, you know, there are still plenty of factors that could turn this back into a bull market at almost the drop of a hat. But provided we don't see one of the three things that I've outlined, then I think that we are in the beginnings of a more bearish and balanced market, and I think it's a market that can go lower.
Peter Butel at Cameron Hanover in New Canaan, Connecticut. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
John McCain and Barack Obama aren't taking any chances on lower oil prices. The two have spent most of the past week praising the virtues of their energy plans and panning the other guys. If some of what you're hearing from them this time around strikes you as new, that's because it is, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
John McCain struck first. Back in the early spring, he proposed a gas tax holiday for the summer driving season. Then, when oil reached more than $130 a barrel, McCain said it was time to end the moratorium on offshore drilling.
I believe it is time for the federal government to lift these restrictions and to put our own reserves to use.
Obama countered that both a gas tax holiday and offshore drilling wouldn't bring prices down anytime soon, if at all.
When I'm president, I intend to keep in place the moratorium here in Florida and around the country and that prevents oil companies from drilling off Florida's coasts.
But this week, Obama said he'd allow limited new exploration offshore. He also said if elected, he'll pass a windfall tax on oil companies, give families $1,000 in emergency energy assistance, and release millions of gallons of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to lower prices. Severin Borenstein is director of the University of California Energy Institute. He says these ideas are a mixed bag.
Some of which will just have no effect at all, like drilling.
Others may push prices down for a while, but
lowering gas prices a bit right now is really not a good energy policy.
Borenstein says gas costs a lot for a very good reason. It's scarce. And if we're going to get out of our energy bind, he says Americans will have to start using less oil. While candidates may hate to admit it, record high gas prices are a great place to start. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The Fed says inflation here is going to flatten out sometime next year, but in many parts of Asia, prices are skyrocketing and giving no sign of doing anything different anytime soon. From Beijing, Lisa Chow reports that's just the cost those countries have to bear for their rapid economic growth.
In the past decade, many Asian economies made money exporting electronics and textiles. For most of that time, workers produced more than they consumed. But wages have steadily grown, and now people want stuff, which means higher prices. Arthur Krober is with economics research firm Dragonomics in Beijing. He says there's another factor contributing to inflation in these countries. Bad roads.
The infrastructure is rotten, and so you just can't get the goods to the people cheap enough or fast enough, so prices rise very rapidly.
Brad Setzer tracks Asian economies for the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He's encouraged by hikes in interest rates in the Philippines and India to tame inflation, but he's less optimistic about China. He says government subsidies for petroleum have kept gas prices low and consumption high.
If I had to guess, I would guess that inflationary pressure will remain significant in China. Well, there's some possibility it may have peaked in countries that have been more willing to take aggressive action to combat inflation.
And then there's food. While Americans spend 10% of their income on food, Chinese, Indians, and Vietnamese spend more than 30%. Higher food prices have sent inflation rates soaring. But just as growth helped trigger inflation, a global economic slowdown may be the cure. As Asia's export economies cool, consumer demand is likely to fall. In Beijing, I'm Lisa Chow for Marketplace.
Traders got a shot in the arm today from oil and the Fed. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The Federal Reserve didn't actually use the phrase subprime in its interest rate announcement this afternoon. They said tight credit conditions instead. But the point's pretty much the same. The liquidity crunch is still with us, and it's spreading. There are some indications investors have soured on a kind of bond backed by credit card debt. Problem is that more people are paying their credit card bills late, or they're not paying them at all. So banks that issue cards aren't extending as much credit on the same generous terms as they used to. That ripple effect is hurting small businesses that use credit cards to pay their way, as Mitchell Hartman reports now from the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk.
All these problems in the credit card market are forcing banks to tighten their lending standards. Bill Connerly is a business consultant and former bank executive in Portland, Oregon.
So the banks are both nervous about credit quality, and they have less resources to make loans on credit cards or to let people carry large balances.
That's particularly troublesome for entrepreneurs. Todd McCracken is president of the National Small Business Association. His group reports nearly half of American entrepreneurs now use credit cards to fund their businesses. He says apart from high interest rates, that carries other risks.
Unlike a traditional bank loan, the credit card companies really reserve the right to change the terms of your loan at almost any time.
Those risks haven't escaped the attention of the Consumer Federation of America. Travis Plunkett's the legislative director. He says credit card firms are jacking up fees and interest rates, including for being late paying other bills you owe.
Imagine what such practices do to a small business trying to make payroll. And if your interest rate doubles or triples with virtually no notice, it can create chaos for small businesses.
Economist Bill Connerly says businesses with stellar credit will still be okay.
But those who have been running into troubles every now and then, been late with some of their payments, boy, it's going to be a world of hurt for them.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Between the Olympics Friday and football fans wondering whether Brett Favre will ever play for the Green Bay Packers again, baseball is at something of a competitive disadvantage right now for media attention. A couple of teams are getting coverage, just not the kind they'd like, I'd wager. Major League Baseball and the FBI have been looking into a kickback scheme. They're trying to figure out whether talent scouts are skimming a little something off the top of the signing bonuses that are given to young players from the Dominican Republic. Last week, the top Dominican scout for the Boston Red Sox was fired over accusations he was involved. And there are reports that at least one employee of the New York Yankees has been up to the same tricks. Ashley Milne-Tite has the story.
About a quarter of players on major league rosters at the start of the season were born in Latin America. Countries like the Dominican Republic and Venezuela have long been fertile ground for major league baseball. University of Chicago economics professor Alan Sanderson says teams have been able to groom the best young talent at so-called baseball academies in those countries.
And talent that would then have allegiances to a particular major league franchise like the Yankees. And then the Yankees or some other club could sign folks out of their academies.
But unlike the U.S. and Canadian amateur draft, says Andy Zimbalist of Smith College, this system of signing young Latin players is unregulated.
You have really throughout the Caribbean, although it's centered in the Dominican Republic, a wild, wild west situation.
He says players are often poverty-stricken. They might come from a family earning a pittance. He says what might seem like a modest signing bonus to an American player is a fortune to a budding Dominican shortstop. And he says these teenagers don't know their worth in the U.S. marketplace, but the scouts do.
And they could make a deal on behalf of the player that is for a much greater sum of money, give the player a relatively modest portion of the total sum, and keep the rest for himself.
Zimbalist says scouts have been doing this for years. Right now, the system is still very much a jungle, but Major League Baseball officials and the FBI will be looking to tame it. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
There's been an unmerger of sorts in the music world. After 5 years of on-again, off-again dealings, Sony and the European media company Bertelsmann have agreed to go their separate ways. Sony's going to buy out Bertelsmann's half of their joint venture, Sony BMG, it's called. Amid the scramble to find ways to make money in the era of digital downloads, the American music industry is discovering that what's old can be new and profitable again. Commercial jingles that were popular a generation or so ago are being used as fodder for today's top 40 songs. Douglas Caballero hosts a music show on Current TV. Douglas, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Going to do something we don't usually do on a business and finance show. We're going to play a little Name That Tune. So let's play this clip and then we'll talk about it. Double your pleasure, double your fun. We've heard that someplace before, right? Help me out here.
Yes, we have. That is Wrigley's Double Mint Gum. That is the slogan.
How did this become a pop tune? Because the last time I remember hearing Double Your Pleasure, Double Your Fun, it was some commercial 30 years ago.
Yeah, they've had a lot of commercials. And as of recently, they haven't been doing that well. This particular song was brought together by two people in the, not in traditional ad game, they're from the more of the urban music and culture realm.
Right.
That's Jay-Z and Steve Stout from Translation Advertising.
Did Wrigley's say, hey, we've got this jingle, everybody in the world knows it, let's try to capitalize on that by making it a pop tune and build it from there?
Something like that. I think some of it had to do with the fact that they're, you know, they are trying to find their target audience because right now their sales were flat in 2007. But as of recently, this gum has appealed to more of an urban audience.
What's the marketing idea here?
Well, this song makes you tap your toe, snap your finger, drive a little bit faster. The song is infectious. Allegedly, Chris Brown wrote it in 30 minutes, which makes me very envious of someone who can write a good song in half an hour. I think it's brand awareness. You know, I think this is just the beginning. It's obviously been successful. The song was, as I checked last week, was number 3 on the Billboard Top 100. So I expect to see more of these moving forward. You know, they want to emulate this success.
Are they doing Doubleman, or are they getting the whole spectrum of the Wrigley brands there?
Doing somewhat of the whole spectrum. They've got Neo, who's another R&B singer, and he's doing Big Red. Mm-hmm. And they've got Julianne Hough, who's a country star, who started off as a dancer on Dancing with the Stars, doing Juicy Fruit.
Do they know, though? Do the kids who are listening to this music know that it's all driven by Wrigley's and corporate America?
As of now, I do not think they do, no.
What do you think the reaction would be? I mean, if we went out and stopped some kids out on the street here, would they say, oh, man?
I think a lot of younger people are very used to, or they're accustomed to advertising and their favorite icons being paired together. Mm-hmm. And so they're not as turned off by things like this now.
It's not like rappers and hip-hoppers haven't used commercial references in music before, though.
Absolutely not. You know, R&B music and hip-hop has definitely been the easiest conduit to advertising, but now those advertisers are making connections to the independent music world.
Yeah.
You've got the new Converse Centennial advertising that's going on right now. They're basically Pharrell, Santo Gold, and Julian Casablancas, three of the biggest stars in independent world, if you want to call it. Independence, probably not the word, best word to use these days. They made a song specifically for an advertisement that's actually a full song, and it's called My Drive Through. It's pretty catchy, and it's very similar. And you know, although it didn't start off as a music video, it started off as a commercial.
Yeah, independent. It's a little bit of being bought by the man, right?
Well, at some point, you know, with music sales being so flat, you've got to figure out how to make money as an artist, and this is one of the ways to do it. And as I said earlier, younger audience they really don't have as much of an aversion to having their favorite icons being paired with brands these days.
Yeah. Douglas Caballero from Current TV. He hosts and produces a program there called The Daily Fix. Douglas, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, plenty of elderly patients, not enough doctors.
No one finds this a surprise, but the magnitude of the gap is what sets people back.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials piled on 2.9% today, 331 points to close at 11,615. The NASDAQ charged up 2.8% today, 64 points, ended at 2,349. The S&P 500 climbed 2.8% as well. That's 35 points to wrap up at 1284. Financial shares had their best day in a week after the Federal Reserve left the key interest rate unchanged. Bank of America deposited a nearly 3% gain. Citigroup shot up 5.75%. JPMorgan Chase banked an extra 4.75%. With crude oil dropping to around $119 a barrel, airline shares took off. Northwest soared 8%. Continental flew up 11.75%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.02%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at the events for Wednesday. President Bush is in Seoul, South Korea, where he meets with President Lee Myung-bak. Afterwards, he travels to Thailand. There he'll meet with that country's prime minister. The National Archives presents a special program on ping-pong diplomacy that recognizes the role the sport played in diplomatic history. And the island country of Jamaica celebrates 46 years as an independent nation. I'm Megan Larson.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The president's in South Korea today for talks. Then he's off to Beijing for the Olympics on Friday. Congress has left Washington as well. Lawmakers have recessed for their summer break and a little campaigning, too. But they left some key policy problems behind them. Energy is one of them. Trade's another. The Colombian Free Trade Agreement that we heard so much about earlier this year has stalled. And commentator Susan Aronson says that's a shame.
U.S. policymakers have used trade agreements for over a century to achieve two very different goals, to expand trade and advance human rights abroad. The Bush administration claims that a new free trade agreement with Colombia will help that troubled country improve the rule of law. But many human rights activists disagree. As a result, the agreement is unlikely to pass Congress this year. Many labor and human rights activists argue that Congress should postpone consideration of the pact until Colombia's human rights performance improves. They don't want to reward countries that don't consistently respect the rule of law. These critics have a point. Colombia's human rights performance is lacking. Labor leaders are often murdered, workers' rights are inadequately protected, and in some regions, terrorists act with impunity. The rule of law might be improving, but it's still inadequate. Critics need to rethink how we can help Colombia continue its positive momentum. The agreement has provisions to bolster both the supply and demand for good governance. Here's how. First, the free trade agreement encourages public participation in trade policymaking. Citizens in both countries gain the right to challenge trade rules. Second, the agreement gives Colombian workers the right to petition the U.S. government to take action. If the Colombian government is found to have violated labor provisions, it may lose trade benefits. In this regard, the agreement is both a carrot and a stick. Finally, empirical studies link expanded trade with improvements in particular human rights, such as freedom from arbitrary imprisonment and extrajudicial killing. Thus, the agreement could also help advance the very human rights that need reinforcement in Colombia. It's important to encourage democracies such as Colombia to maintain human rights progress. And the best way to do that is to provide them with real incentives. The free trade agreement does that.
Susan Aronson is professor of international affairs at the George Washington University. Her most recent book is called Trade Imbalance. Let us hear from you. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Older Americans spend more time and more money in the healthcare system than almost any other age group. But other than family, they don't often have much help juggling their particular mixtures of ailments and medications. There are doctors who specialize in caring for the elderly, but geriatricians are in short supply, as Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll reports.
How's life?
It's fine.
Life is good?
Yeah.
How's your hearing?
Fridtjof Sjostrand is meeting with his geriatrician, David Rubin. He just got over a respiratory infection. Dr. Rubin checks Fridtjof's heartbeat and listens to his cough. He asks about a blood thinner medication that he thinks might be affecting his patient's memory. Fridtjof is 95.
There was a little confusion last time. Is everything clear upstairs here?
Yeah, I think.
Dr. Rubin heads up UCLA's geriatrics program. It's one of only 39 in the country that trains geriatric fellows. Rubin's been Fridtjof's primary doctor for decades. Fridtjof's wife, Birgitta, says he would be deaf without Rubin's intervention.
You know, like my husband just got a cochlear implant, and if it hadn't been for Dr. Rubin pushing it, we would not be able to talk together.
First, Rubin had to convince a specialist to do the procedure, and then he pushed to have it covered by insurance. Expensive hearing devices like that aren't usually recommended for someone Fridtjof's age. Rubin says overseeing an elderly patient's complicated medical care is just part of his job.
Sometimes I refer to it as a quarterback, but it's kind of more than a quarterback. It's kind of like almost like a head coach. You know, it's really coordinating things. It's communicating. It's getting everybody on board.
But only 7,000 of those quarterbacks are on the field these days. The number of geriatricians has dropped 22% from 8 years ago. With 71 million Americans heading toward old age, healthcare experts say elder care could be in crisis.
No one finds this a surprise, but the magnitude of the gap is what sets people back.
Dr. Stuart Altman is a professor of national health policy at Brandeis University. He says the insurance system is biased against doctors like geriatricians who concentrate on preventive medicine to keep patients healthier longer. He says doctors get paid more to treat patients than to talk to them.
The way the health system pays the workers in it, it has a very strong bias in favor of high-tech services, highly specialized services, and primarily services for acute care.
As a result, geriatricians make a quarter to a third less than other specialists. Visit one of those websites that ranks medical careers. Geriatrics always comes in dead last. Still, geriatrics has some takers, like Elizabeth Goodman.
Here she is, the one left, yes, the last Mohican.
Goodman's doing a rotation in UCLA's geriatrics program. She chose the specialty for its holistic approach.
I think very often in most aspects of adult medicine, we really only spend the time to focus on people's disease processes. And sometimes we don't get to ask as much as we'd like about what their social situation is, what their quality of life is.
The federal government offers loan forgiveness for geriatric training, and lawmakers are pushing for more incentives. There's also talk of creating a geriatric service corps to bring more people to the field.
You guys should be okay. You're okay with scripts and all?
For patients like the Sjostrens, seeing a doctor who understands their needs as seniors has made all the difference.
Remember before you always said that people looked at you like you were stupid because you couldn't hear?
Well, yeah, that's true. No, too much.
Not anymore. you can hear everything. The question for the millions of baby boomers is, will there be a geriatrician there to listen? In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note to follow up on a story from last week. We had Stuart Bowen on. He's the Special Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. His latest quarterly report had suggested that the United States doesn't really need to spend any more money rebuilding Iraq. Bowen told us the Iraqis can't really figure out how to spend the money they already have. Well, a report out today from the Government Accountability Office put an exclamation point on that. The GAO says high oil prices are going to give Iraq a $79 billion budget surplus by the end of this year. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 331 points, 2.9% after the Fed's rate cut announcement, or non-rate cut, I guess you'd say. The NASDAQ gained 64 points, 2.8%. The S&P 500 hiked up 35 points, also 2.8% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, shaving profits from sawdust.
It may come to a time where the byproducts are going to be the saving grace of the lumber industry.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.